Such a great song for this series that we're in, called Vertical 4. It's on the Ten Commandments of all things, right? But here's what they are. The Ten Commandments are the guideposts for living in a relationship with a God who loves us so well, where we open our hearts and surrender our lives to His purposes and His ways. And we say to ourselves, how do I do that? How do I live for this God who loves me so? Well, here it is. Clear and straightforward guidelines. We call this part of this series V4 because it's the first four of the commandments, and they're about the vertical dimension, the V part. How to live with God. The H6, the other six of the Ten Commandments, are about how to live in relationship with each other. We'll get to that at another point. But for now, V4. What's that all about? There's four straightforward parts of the relationship. I call these like foundational posts on which the home of the relationship with God is built. Here they are. First of all, no other gods. Second is no idols. The third is respect the name. And the fourth, remember to rest. We're unpackaging each of them. Last time we talked about having no other gods before me. This one is what I call the sleeper commandment. It's the sleeper because it's so easy for us to assume that in our culture and in our homes, it just doesn't apply. You shall have no idols before me. I don't have any idols. I don't live in a culture or a country or in a place where I set this thing up on the mantle in my house and bow down. It doesn't apply, right? Today I want to show you how this commandment not only applies, but is at the very base of all of the other commandments, and how relevant and critical it is for us to see it and apply it to our lives. I want to help you to see this morning that if you break any of the other commandments of God, the relational boundary markings, if you break any of them, you've first broken this one. And in the opposite sense, if you keep any of the commandments, it's because you're keeping this one. Extraordinarily relevant for our lives. Well, having said that, you're probably thinking to yourself, okay, you're telling me it's important, but I don't get it. I don't see the connection. No idols. I don't have one. Think about how you might have one. Watch this video clip.
The Bible teaches us that idolatry is something that we as Christians are to avoid at all costs. Praising an object instead of God is disrespectful and a sin. Fortunately, in this day and age, there aren't any statues of Baal sitting around, so idolatry is pretty much impossible. Now, if you'll excuse me, I'm going to go sit in front of my new flat-screen TV. The picture is so perfect and wonderful. This new TV has brought meaning to my life and shown me the light in high definition. It is a great and excellent television, worthy of my attention. I love this TV. These have been deep thoughts from a shallow Christian.
All right, are you starting to get the idea? Here we go. Let's take a look at this commandment. I'm going to talk to you about idolatry in Bible times. Then I'm going to talk to you about idolatry today. And then finally, how to keep this relational boundary in a way that honors God and blesses our lives. So, idolatry in Bible times. How did it work? What did it look like? Turn with me in the Bibles to page 177. There are Bibles under your chairs. If you're new here, you'll just take a look there. You'll find one. 177 in those Bibles is Deuteronomy chapter 5. While you're turning there, just a quick reminder of the historical and cultural context. You've got the nation of Israel who was called to be, listen to this, called to be a witness to the nations around them, to reflect the love of God, to obey and follow Him with all of their heart. Their job was always to be a witness to the people around them. And part of the way to do it was by keeping these 10 boundary posts, these 10 foundational posts of the relationship with God. So here we are. They've been given the commandments about 40 years prior. They had broken them severely. They had wandered as a result in wilderness times. And now they've come out of it. They're about to enter the promised land, the land which, by the way, they live in today, called Israel or Canaan at that time. Before they enter that land, they're reminded of these Ten Commandments. And the first one we looked at last week, which is in Deuteronomy 5, verse 7, you shall have no other gods before me. You see that? Now in verse 8, you shall not make for yourself an idol in the form of anything in heaven above, or on the earth beneath, or in the waters below. Now, other than that, outside of that, you're free to make idols, okay? But just not in the heavens above, in the earth below, or in the waters under. All right? So anywhere else you can go, you're okay. Got it? There is nowhere you can traverse in this planet. There's nowhere a spaceship can take you. There's nowhere a submarine can take you where you have the freedom to violate this boundary line. No idols. What does that mean? What does that look like? By the way, keep your Bibles open, at least a finger in it, to this text. We'll come back to it later on in the message. Here we are. What is this? What is idolatry in Bible times? Primarily, it is the carving of wood, stone, gold, or silver to make an object. So in those days, they would take a piece of wood, for example, they'd carve it into an object, and it would become their idol. Second, they would attach to it the power of the deity. So they would take that object and they would give to it the power that that deity they're trying to worship had. Let me try to help you see how that works in Bible times. Let me use the example of Israel. Up on the screen, you're going to see Exodus 32, verse 1 to 5. And here you've got Moses, the story of Moses getting the commandments initially. He's coming down the mountain, and the people are gathering around Aaron. They're waiting for Moses, the leader, to come. They go to Aaron, the high priest, and they say to him, "Come, let us make God's will go before us. As for this fellow Moses who brought us up out of Egypt, we don't know what's happened to him." Aaron answered them, "Take the gold earrings that are your wives, your sons, and your daughters are wearing. Bring them to me." So all the people took off their earrings and brought them to Aaron. He took what they handed him, and he made it into an idol cast in the shape of a calf, fashioned it with a tool. Then they said, "These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt." When Aaron saw this, he built an altar in front of the calf and announced, "Tomorrow there will be a festival to the Lord." Now, let's just hold it there and keep that that up there on the wall for a minute. In Bible times, they would take an object. So in this case, you know, everybody hand up their gold earrings. All right, let's put it into a pot. Let's melt it down. Let's shape it into the form of a calf. That calf is an object that we will give or attach a power to as our idol. Now, let me explain this just a little bit more. The idea here was not necessarily to create a god, but a representation of a part of that god. So in this example, there's really two ways that you can look at it. Some of the commentaries I've read say that what they were doing here was creating an alternative god to the God of heaven and earth. The calf was a different god. But a number of the readings that I've done, and it just really makes sense to me, look at it this way, that the calf that they made is a representation of a part of the God they had come to learn about. So this God they had come to know was a God of power, right? Well, in those days, the calf or the bull was a representation of power. So by making a calf, they'd be attaching the power of this God that they had come to learn about to the calf, and then they could worship that calf. And by worshiping it, and this is the third part, they could worship the object in order to connect to its power. They could worship that calf, and by worshiping it, they would somehow connect the power of this God through the calf, and it would come to them to benefit them. It would give them what they're looking for in life. Now, what does God think about that? In Isaiah 42, verse 8, it says, "I am the Lord, and that is my name. I will not give my glory to another or my praise to idols." I don't want you making anything that represents me. I don't want you making anything besides me. Anything you make will limit who I am. It will be demeaning to my character. It will diminish the authority that I have. So the Israelites, who thought that they could make an idol to represent a part of who God is, and by worshiping it, draw that power to themselves, were actually forgetting about the God Himself and focusing on the object for what they could get from it. Now, in that text that I had up on the screen a minute ago, you may have noticed that it said at the end of that, worshiping it in order to worship the Lord. Tomorrow, it says, there will be a festival to the Lord. That's that Hebrew word that's often used for God. In Aaron's mind, this was going to be a worshiping of God by worshiping the calf. And God says, you don't worship me by making an image, something that I've created on this earth, and using that to draw attention to myself. That's not the way you do it. So God was offended by that. If you have your Bible still open, by the way, in a chapter earlier, in Deuteronomy 4, you have the idea of this worshiping of the idol, where it says, you saw no form. This is verse 15 to 19. You saw no form of any kind the day the Lord spoke to you at Horeb. Therefore, watch yourselves very carefully so you don't become corrupt and make for yourselves an idol. And then if you skip down a little further, it says, do not be enticed. This is in verse 19. Do not be enticed into bowing down to them and worshiping things the Lord your God has apportioned to all the nations under heaven. In other words, don't take something that I've given you to enjoy or to have on this planet. Don't take a calf or a sheep or a serpent. Remember that story, by the way? That one point where the Israelites were really acting out. I mean, they were just really going crazy. And God sent venomous snakes that bit them and they were dying. As the people were dying, they said, help! And so God allowed Moses to put up on a statue this image of a snake. And people who would look to it would be healed. It was an act of obedience to God to look at the snake. But guess what happened? In the years that followed after that, people began to worship the snake. They attributed some of the power of God through that snake, and by worshiping it, they thought they could draw that power. They could become strong. Thank goodness for a guy named King Hezekiah, who we're told in 1 Kings 18, comes along and he destroys that snake. Because people had turned something God had used to draw people to him, they had turned it into an object to worship for themselves. That's idolatry in Bible times. Now let's talk about idolatry today. How does this apply to us? What does it mean for us? First of all, let me give you the kind of the overview of how it works, and then I'm going to help drive it home for our benefit and for our conviction. First of all, idolatry is primarily turning good things into ultimate things. Now you got to think about that for a minute. Turning good things into ultimate things. Idolatry is taking something that is needful and useful, like money or a car in the driveway or a possibility of a job promotion or the beauty of sex that God has provided, taking something good and making it ultimate, putting it so high at a level of priority and importance that other things begin to fade in comparison. It applies to all kinds of stuff, to fame, to money, to our nationality, to our ethnicity, to our health. I want to be healthy, and I put that as such an important thing in my life that it becomes an ultimate issue for me. 1 John 5, verse 21, in the New Testament as well as in the Old, we have the reminder, dear children of God who loves you, keep yourself from idols. So idolatry in the New Testament is turning good things into ultimate things and then attaching power to that item, power that belongs to God alone. So it becomes for you something that you can draw from. So you worship it, thirdly, in order to draw power from it. You get something from it. So you turn a good thing into an ultimate thing, you attach a power to it, and then you draw from it to benefit for yourself. Do you get the message in all this, by the way? The outcome, the outtake of this, is for yourself. It's the benefit you derive. Now let me put some flesh on this. What does that look like in very practical terms? How does that work? There's a text I want us to look at. It's Colossians 3, verse 5 and 6, where Paul writes to the Colossian people, and he says to them, part of living a godly life within relationship with Him is putting to death what belongs to the earthly nature, sexual immorality. Again, sex is a good thing within the boundary God has provided. But put to death the immorality of it, impurity, lust, evil desires. And now look at this. Look at this. Greed, which is what? What's the word? Idolatry. How is greed idolatry? How does greed, what does he mean? Greed, which is idolatry. Because of these, the wrath of God is coming. Here's how it works. Greed is the gotta have it, right? So bad that you'll violate standards you otherwise would normally not violate in order to get it. Okay, so let's use an example. It's finally turning a little bit warmer this time of year, right? So you're out shopping an evening, a Friday evening, and you end up at a store that sells pools. Okay? Now, you've recently decided in your family that you're maxed out financially and that you're not going to make any big purchases until next year, except for the basic necessities. But you're out shopping, it's a warm day, the kids have been crying all summer long about wanting to go to the pool, and here you could buy one. And guess what? It's on sale. Isn't that remarkable? I mean, it's like this marvelous confluence of events. So you reason and rationalize. And by the end of the night, guess what you've done? You've had the store call the credit card company to up your credit limit so you could walk out of there with the pool. What just happened? You got a case of the gotta have it, right? And it violated something that you normally wouldn't do, but you just had to. That's greed. And it's also, Paul says, idolatry. Here's how it works. That pool, that physical pool that you now put in your ground, let's say it's an in-ground pool, okay? So they come, they set it. That pool becomes your idol. How? It becomes an object, something that's good in itself, but it becomes ultimate. Ultimate to the level that you are willing to violate a commitment that you had previously made. Maybe you had made it to God, but you so wanted it in a moment of impulsivity, you caved and you went and got it. A good became an ultimate. And guess what you did? You attached a power to it. A power that you worshipped. How does that work? What's the power you attach to it? Think through the rationalizing process. If we get the pool, it'll make the kids happy. If I get the pool, I'll have a better summer. My life will be a little more enjoyable, satisfying. I'll have a little more enjoyment and I'll feel better. It's been a rough year. There's been so many lousy things that have happened. It'll lift my spirits if I get the pool. You attach the power to the pool, and then you gave it attention. You obsessed about it. You thought about it. You rationalized around it. You bowed to it to the level where you violated a commitment and a standard that you otherwise would normally do. That's worship. You sacrificed for it, right? Idolatry. It's not really that complicated. We do it all the time. So, a couple other examples. Why do you sometimes lie? Why is it tempting for me to exaggerate the truth or to tell a story that's not really real or to characterize something in a way that puts me in a better light? Why? Is it maybe because the person that I tell the lie to is someone that I have attached a power to that doesn't belong to them? Where I look to them to provide me with a sense of ego satisfaction, a higher sense of value of who I am. I need them to like me. I want them to enjoy my presence. I need them to think that I'm good, that I'm a valuable and important person. So I tell, normally I wouldn't lie. Normally I know and think about the fact that God frowns on it, that God requires me to live with full honesty. But in this case, with this person, for what they can give to me, for the power I attach to them, I'm willing to sacrifice. It's idolatry. And there's a worship component because you sacrifice something of importance. Your own integrity for what that person can give you. All across the board, we do this kind of thing. We do it in the financial areas. We do it in our careers. So value, so much want that job promotion. Give it so much time and attention, attach a power for what it can do for me in terms of my sense of significance and meaning and value and fulfillment of what my life will end up like. I sometimes wondered in this whole sexual area, such a gift from God. And yet people, well-meaning, God-fearing people who try to serve God well, violate the standard often. It's a hard one because there's like an internal desire within us for the sexual area. And we violate it. Why do we do it? Is it because maybe something deep inside of us says, I need to connect with that person on the deepest of levels. I need that connection for me to have a sense of who I am. I crave romance and affection and attention and all the things that sex will provide for me. And that becomes my... I give the power to that. And that person that I draw to myself. Or that image on the screen for those who struggle with pornography. I give the power to that. To fulfill and satisfy me something that's lacking. For moments when I feel down, when I need an escape, when I feel empty inside. And so people sleep with their boyfriends and their girlfriends before they're married, though they know that God really says you need to wait until marriage. Because we make an idol out of the person or the object, and we attach a power and we sacrifice something for it. Finally, we sacrifice our own integrity and the honor of God. And God says to us, you shall have no idols before me. Dear children, keep yourself from idols. And so as we think about this, how do you back away? How do you keep this relational boundary? That's what I want to wrap us up with today. How do you get to the place where you identify any idols in your life? By the way, I just got to tell you this was so helpful for me. After the service, somebody came up to me and said to me something that really helps to identify where the idols are in their life. Notice I said where, not if. I would dare say every one of us here, with that definition, that understanding, can see that there are idols. So, you want to figure it out? Here's what you do. So this guy said, show me your checkbook. Show me your planner or your palm or your Outlook calendar or whatever it is. And show me your bookshelf. Well, let's update that a little bit. Show me your DVD collection. Show me what's in your iPod. Show me the movies that you go to. You show me some basic things and I'll show you your idols. Show me where the priorities are in your time, your money, your attention. Show me the things you obsess about. Show me the things where you violate other parts of your character, and I'll show you your idol. If you have a heart, as I do, to keep this relational boundary, here's what you need to do. Number one, you need to receive God's jealousy. You need to welcome it. You know, jealousy's gotten a pretty bad rap, and in many cases, it's a very bad thing, especially in human relationships. Jealousy gets all warped. But when it comes from God, it's as pure can get. Jealousy is simply saying, I want to be exclusively yours and you to be exclusively mine. You know how this works in the relationship, the V the vertical dimension. God says, I made you, I love you, I welcome you, and now you must reciprocate. No competitors, no rivals. How does it say it? Well, if you still have your Bibles open, finger in that text, Deuteronomy 5. Here's how it reads in verse 9 and 10. You shall not bow down to them or worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sin of the fathers to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me. I could talk along that line for a long time. There are cycles of idolatry, of putting certain things, certain objects, certain desires at a premier level that replace God or put God in second place. It's a generational thing. We tend to catch it from the parents who came before. And God punishes it. I love the other part. Goes on and says, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and who keep my commandments. Receive the jealousy of God is a good thing. God says, I want to be exclusive in this relationship. No competitors, no rivals. And then second, replace the idols with one image. This is really interesting to me. This is something Tristan talked to me about earlier in the week, and it got me thinking all week long. Isn't it interesting that in the Old Testament, it says you shall have no graven images. And then in the New Testament, what does God do? He gives us Jesus, who is called the image of the invisible God. Colossians 1 verse 15. He's the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. He is the image that is appropriate to worship. He's given us a replacement. And guess what's unique about this replacement? It is no inanimate object. Because you know what inanimate objects are. They're things you can move, things you can shift around, things you can manipulate and control for your benefit. That's what idolatry is fundamentally. It's using something, attaching a power to it, so you can get from it what you need to fulfill your own wants and desires. But you can't do that in a healthy relationship with a person. You can't do that. Jesus is a person. Jesus is God. And Jesus put on human flesh and came to this planet so we could have an idea of what God is all about. And so you replace all of the other idols and images that you draw power from for your benefit, and you stand there and you look and say, who is this Jesus? And you get to know the diversity of who he is. That's the last part. Discover the diversity of that image. Get to know him for who he is. Because here's the thing. You might get to know somebody. Let's say you meet somebody at the store and you see them maybe every week. It's a person in the checkout line, or maybe it's a person who works in the produce department, and you have brief conversations. You get to know a slice of who that person is. But you don't really know the person in their entirety. You can be married to a person for years and not know them in their entirety. Explore the diversity of this image, who God really is. That will keep you from idols. How? You will spend time exploring the beauty of God in all of his wonder. What you'll learn of him is that he is a dignified individual. You'll learn he's majestic. You'll learn that he is gracious and loving and forgiving. You'll learn that he holds you accountable for how you live your life. You'll learn that he is gracious to guide you along the way and to forgive you when you mess up. You'll learn that he is a God of fairness and of justice when everything else around you is messed up. And you feel like life is so unfair, you can turn to him, you'll find he is a God of fairness. And that he brings ultimate justice in the big scope of things. You'll learn so many things about this God. And as you do, as you focus on that image and you let the other things fade to second, guess what will happen? You'll be able to evaluate everything else through the lens of your worship of this God, through his son Jesus. You'll be able to look at that in-ground pool before you buy it and make a decision wisely based on God first orientation. It's that practical. In the last service I mentioned, one of the key ways that we exhibit idolatry today is in the area of our children. There is such a tendency to elevate the status of our kids, love them as we do, but to such a high level where we attach a power to them that they're never meant to have. We find a sense of who we are in our children. We need them to have good, positive lives because that makes us feel better about ourselves. We can't afford to have them angry with us, so we don't dare to discipline them. So we have a culture of kids running around who are demeaning to their parents because the parents don't have the strength. Why? Because they've attached a power to their kids to give them a sense of who they are. They need their kids to love them. They need their kids to be happy with them. Isn't there something messed up about that? That's idolatry. Attaching a power to someone or something, you do it with your spouse, you do it with your neighbor, you maybe do it with your boss. You attach a power to them that only God deserves to have. How you keep this boundary is that you separate from that power and you attach to God. And by understanding Him in all of His diversity, you help to see through His lens how to love your kids without getting attached to them in that power kind of way. You learn how to nurture and care for and treasure them with all your heart, but to do it in a way that worships God first. My dear children, as John said, keep yourself from idols. Worship God and God alone. Let's stand for prayer. Father in heaven, I'm so grateful that you've given us this boundary. Because the more I think about it, the more I understand how rampant idolatry is in my life. How I look to something or someone and attach to it a power that only you deserve. Oh God, forgive. Give us a moment of sanity in all of this that will translate into a lifetime of evaluation and of rooting out anything that becomes a competitor to you so that we can worship you, O God, and you alone. That we can see from our checkbook and we can see from our daytime planner and we can see from our DVD collection or other things that are of key importance in our life. We can see where idolatry is either already in full flame, or we can see where it's beginning to grow. And then, God, in your strength, will you help us to turn our eyes back to you, to the image of your Son, who images you perfectly, and to see in you, O God, what really matters, who really is in charge, who really gives us a sense of who we are. O God, would you give us clean hands? Would you give us pure hearts? May we not lift our soul to another. Remove our idols, God, so we can worship only you. Let's sing that song together.